This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. The title of this particular tape is Why Be Catholic, Tape 1. Allow me, as a type of introduction, to point out that I am not Joseph Cowley, but I am Vin Lewis. I am the founder and president of All Roads Ministry. This tape is officially attributed to Joseph Cowley, but he is not the speaker. Joseph Cowley did, in fact, record the original version of this tape, but due to some technical difficulties, it was judged that it would be better to re-record it, and also, due to some technical difficulties, Joseph Cowley was not available to record it the second time. However, let me point out, if I may, that the source of all truth and the source of all good is God. The means by which that truth and goodness is transported or communicated to us is frequently not a matter of concern, except for matters concerning authority. It does not matter who says which truth. Truth is independent of the speaker. If you were to read the Bible, it does not matter if that Bible were printed, typeset, transported, and bound by a Catholic, a Protestant, a Muslim, a Jew, or an atheist. So, I would like you to take the following approach when you listen to this tape. Do not consider or give any value to who is the author of it, or who is speaking, or whose particular insights are being expressed. Instead, simply evaluate it as a work standing by itself, and do not become concerned with the personality or the persons involved in its production. To give a simple example of this, Jesus, of course, tells us of the prodigal son in a parable. The value of that story would not be any less if there never were a man with two sons, one of whom left his household and later returned. With that in mind, I would like to start with the tape proper. Why Be Catholic? Subtitled, Comments from a Convert. Allow me to explain why I feel that my views, namely these comments from a convert, may be of value to you. You may easily ask yourself, why and how does he think that his evaluations are worthwhile? He is new to true faith, is he not? Let him learn. Let him be humble, lest, as St. Paul advises St. Timothy, 1st Epistle to Timothy, chapter 3, he become filled with conceit. For St. Paul writes that new converts should not be leaders in the true church. But I am not presenting this as a leader. I present this as a recent but no longer stranger. I have no official status in the church except as one who is a sinner and is therefore working out his salvation in fear and trembling, as St. Paul writes in Philippians chapter 2. Yet, is it not arrogant of me to presume that what I see is worth relating to you? Is this work, this tape, this talk, worth your effort to learn from it? Are my questions worth your money to worship them? Are my comments worth what you must spend? These are good questions. Let me answer these questions with a story. Once a man was at the home of a girl whom he was dating. The girl's father and the guest were discussing politics. The father had been drinking a bit. his tone became a bit strong. He never became coarse, nor did he ever attack the guest personally. After the guest left, the sister of the girl called him at home. She apologized for her father's behavior. She tried to explain it on the alcohol. The man laughed. His own father had been a real problem drinker. If she wanted to see real arguments, he said, then he should see his father and him argue a subject. What caused this unnecessary apology of the sister? It was because she was one of the family. She could not see things the way they were because she was conflicted by the feelings of embarrassment and defensiveness with concern for her own father and concern for her sister. She had no idea how other families behaved. She had no idea what a problem family was. How could she? She had only been born into one, her own. The reason the guest could comment on the behavior and judge it to be not so bad was that he came from something which was, objectively at least, worse. He was able to supply to the sister a sense of comfort which came from an objectivity, which came from being both a stranger and a welcome guest. Sometimes such people, that is, former strangers but now welcome guests, can point out things which the family cannot see. Sometimes it's because something which has always been there can no longer be noticed by the family. The people who appreciate the great works of art the very least are most probably those who work as guards in the museums and the galleries. These works are too familiar, and the guards are too busy making certain that no one touches the artwork and giving directions and looking at the clock, waiting for their shifts to end. You cradle Catholics, that is to say those who were born Catholics and remain Catholics all their lives, are similar to the daughter of the father and the museum guard. Let a stranger make a few comments. Maybe it would be worth your while for you to see what you already have. Let me make a partial inventory of the treasures for you. For the sake of clarity, I have divided this set of comments into a few major subdivisions. They are not directly related, except that they are all aspects which, in my opinion, need to be more widely known. Subdivision 1, leaving a winning team for a losing team. In the 1950s, when communism was a real threat to America, a man named Whitaker Chambers deserted the Communist Party, which he had been serving as a spy, and became, in his own words, an informer on his former friends and colleagues. Chambers wrote that the reason he changed sides was that he became convinced by looking at the ear of his own daughter that there must be a God. He could now no longer give loyalty to an atheistic system. He also wrote that because of the weaknesses of the Western communities, their moral decay, and the strength of communism, he judged that he was leaving the winning side and joining the losing side. First, Chambers was not a Catholic and therefore apparently not aware of the promises made by Our Lady at Fatima. Chambers did not live to see the entire political situation, which now so appears to be different from his time, the 1950s. In other words, it seems less clear now that he joined the losing side. However, to him, it did seem this way. Why would anyone do this? Go from the winning side to the losing side. The only reason is that there is something more important than winning. Maybe I should rephrase this. Winning as an individual is more important than being on the winning team. I do not have to tell you that in the conflict between the world and the Catholic Church, it does not seem that the Church is winning. In fact, it seems that everywhere the conflict is over and the battle completely lost. Abortion is available virtually everywhere. Contraception is considered a normal part of everyday life. Most people ignore the authority of the Church, and this includes both Catholics and non-Catholics. Bishops refuse to defend the faith even against rebellious feminist nuns who owe them formal obedience. The media attacks Catholic views as irrelevant at best and laughable at worst. The churches are often empty, even on Sundays and holy days of obligation, and Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament is ignored or not given proper veneration. Let me give, very briefly, another view, and then let me tell you why people such as I will leave that winning team of the world to become a member of the losing team of the Catholic Church. There was another loser quite a long time ago. While everyone else did the conventional thing, his actions were not only out of style, but utterly ridiculous. This fellow spent his time in a task which the local papers would have reported as silly, as a Catholic expecting the world to accept Jesus as its temporal Lord and ruler. The media would have described this fellow, with patient condensation, as a harmless lunatic. You know the type. He's the fellow who builds a boat in his backyard because the flood is coming, and, poor deluded fellow, he believes that only he will be saved, and only those he lets onto his ark. The TV reporter would stand in front of the man building this boat and smile patronizingly. Poor fellow. Well, he's harmless, isn't he? Then the news girl will laughingly ask of the weather forecaster whether we are in for a lot of rain or not. However, once this loser, and I think you know who I'm referring to, became the world's greatest winner. He was the only one who lived and the only one who saved his family, and he was the one who saved the animals. He was Noah. Noah left the winning world because the world was going to be destroyed at its moment of victory. And Noah wanted to be saved from this destruction. And there was going to be only one boat. And today there is only one boat, the bark of St. Peter. Outside of it is the flood. And the clouds now are dark, and it seems like rain is coming. The losing team, the Catholic Church, looks like a losing team because the game is not yet over. In fact, our side has not yet begun to fight. When it begins to rain, then the real winning team will be identified and take the field. The Protestant world is the world of which St. Paul spoke of when he called the world a source of evil. The Protestant world, and by that I mean the secular world, because the two are interchangeable, the Protestant world changes its views to keep up with the world and the styles and the fashions. If contraception becomes bothersome, then, according to the Protestant world and the secular world, it is no longer a sin, but an obligation. If divorce becomes common, then according to the Protestant world and the secular world, it is not only allowed, but encouraged as a source to solving problems within a marriage. Who really wants to be on a team which will do anything to win? winning only counts, as the second part of that famous quote from Vince Lombardi goes, when it is done fairly within the rules. Whitaker Chambers did not know what would happen when he came over to the free world. Noah did not know exactly when it would start to rain. But Noah labored, apparently in vain, for quite a long time, and he suffered the ridicule of his neighbors. Abraham was told that he would be the father of a great many nations, but he did not even have one son until he was very old. Real faith means doing what is in accord to the word of God, even when the world rejects it, and even when there seems to be no result, no points put on the scoreboard, and certainly no progress made to winning. This is why one would leave the winners and join the losers. It's because the game is not over yet. Subdivision 2, real freedom. There is probably no more confusing aspect to human life than the concept of freedom. I do not intend to get into a long philosophical discussion on this nature of freedom. Allow me to simply say that my own view is this. Freedom is that ability to choose between two good things. No one is free to do evil or to choose evil. Freedom comes from God as a gift, and all divine gifts are given to us for good. Thus, no man is free, in the proper sense of the word freedom, to do evil, because this is, by definition, the opposite of good. One might think, if you look at the Protestant, that he has far more freedom than does the Catholic. Look at the situation briefly. The Catholic is bound, for as long as he lives, to obey an institution which will tell him when to go to church, when and what to confess, and to whom he must confess, and then, of course, to be bound by the penance he receives. He must believe what others tell him to believe. He must say the prayers that others have written. He must understand the Bible as others teach it. In contrast, observe the Protestant. In every denomination, in every congregation, in every sect, the people, as opposed to the hierarchy, if it exists, have the major role in determining what is believed, what is taught, what is done, etc. The degree of influence and control varies, but it is always there. The Protestant is, in essence, a democrat in religious matters, and democracy means the maximum exercise of freedom of choice, does it not? The Protestant reads his own Bible. He may freely choose among various translations, and then comes to his own conclusions. If he does not approve of what the minister says in one church, then he goes to another church and another until he finds ones that he approves of or feels comfortable with. He is free to accept the doctrines which he believes and to reject those which do not intellectually convince him. No one can force the individual Protestant to accept what he does not freely choose to accept. It would seem that this is a major selling point, to use a marketing term, for Protestantism, and something which would keep someone out of the Roman Church, wouldn't it? After all, it appears to be almost limitless freedom versus great restrictions. But, as with much in life, appearances are often deceiving. In fact, the democratic nature of the Protestant churches is a tyranny. The root meaning of the word tyranny means to rule by one's own abilities rather than by law or traditional means of authority. When we deal with the matter of the church, what role can people have, that is, the average person? How does the will of the people have anything to do with truth? When has the majority rule ever determined right or wrong? If all truth comes from God, and it does, then the true church will demand that its members accept that truth or be damned as a result of their rejection. It will not examine every moral or theological issue as if it is a question yet to be decided and yet to be voted on. This is a question to be decided by the creatures and not already decided by the Creator. That is the view of the Protestant. The creature will decide the truth, not the Creator. One of the facts of the Incarnation is this: the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And this Word was Jesus. And this Word is truth. Things are no longer open for discussion. Man is no longer allowed this freedom to determine his own truth. He is only allowed the freedom, by his free will, to accept truth and then be on the road to salvation, or the freedom to go his own way and to endure damnation. No man is free to reject truth without suffering the consequences, any more than a man who jumps off a building by denying intellectually the existence of gravity will prevent himself from falling. All of this is somewhat abstract and philosophical. There are real, everyday, living experiences, however, which involve the emotions, and they shall prove the point at which I am driving. I shall briefly mention a few of them. Recall again, we're dealing with the concept of real freedom and why one would become a Catholic in order to experience real freedom. I presume that I am not the first to point out that there is most conformity and the least freedom where there is the least formal enforcement of the rules of conformity. I shall illustrate this. On the roads, the highways, where the rules of the road, the traffic laws, are rigidly proscribed and can be strictly enforced, thousands, actually millions, of intentional violations occur every hour in the United States, as anyone who ever has driven can easily testify. Yet we have an entire category of people whose very existence is justified solely by the enforcement of conformity upon the drivers. These people are the traffic police. Compare this dangerous and frequently fatal anarchy, the de facto anarchy, on the roads with people's behavior at a Broadway theater. No usher police exist. Yet people applaud at the correct time, remain silent at the correct time. They take only the seat they are assigned, and they remain in it. Observe even the so-called nonconformist teenager at a concert of the type of the music of his own choice. He is loud and excited when it is expected for him to be loud and excited. There are no concert police at rock concerts to issue citations if he misbehaves. Have any of us ever seen at a church service the equal of a driver blasting past a red light several seconds after it is changed and nearly causing an intersection in a busy nearly causing an accident in a busy intersection? Have we ever seen someone get up and denounce publicly and vehemently and perhaps profanely the theology of the minister, as drivers will do on the road, commenting on the drivers, the driving behavior of the people they share the road with. Perhaps it has happened, but it is so rare that it cannot be compared to speeding or double parking or the anger and verbal violence, which is so common on our that we largely ignore them. It is true that on occasion, a person may attend a wedding improperly dressed, but the vast majority of us follow a rigid set of rules, and yet there is no formal penalty for disobedience if we misbehave or dress improperly at a wedding. This sense of conformity is called peer pressure. It is what we all denounce in our children while we all obey it rigidly ourselves. When we become adults, we call peer pressure manners or etiquette. We do not see what we do as being rigidly in conformity with an alien set of rules. We see it simply as behaving the way we should behave. This is one reason why an outsider can see what controls us, because the outsider sees these rules as artificial and unnatural, while the insider sees them as organic, inherent, and natural. The Protestant is rigidly controlled by a man-made system, or several man-made systems. Worship services are geared only towards one goal, conformity.
At this time, please turn over to side two, where the discussion will continue. Thank you. This is on tape. Why Be Catholic, tape one, side two. It's a Joseph Calley audio tape.
The Protestant is rigidly controlled by a man-made system, or several man-made systems. Worship services are geared only towards one goal, conformity. Even if the denomination encourages spontaneous demonstrations, such as the shouting of Amen, whenever anyone in the congregation wants, it was peer pressure which decided that such behavior is not only acceptable, but required. It is not an act of freedom to shout out in such groups any more than it is an act of freedom for a minister to wear a suit and tie when he conducts services. No one does otherwise, even though there is no formal code nor formal penalty for disobedience. It is because this authority is not formal, it is because it is hidden, that this fact is not easily recognized. But this power of conformity exists nonetheless. The Protestant is always keeping up with the times. The minister must realize, as is always said on the TV talk shows, that these are no longer the 60s or the 70s. He must alter his message for the new generation. He must keep up with the new trends in the fields of psychology and theology. As with all fashions and all styles, he must run very hard merely to stay in place and not to lose ground. He's on a treadmill called the rat race. The master with which the Protestant must please is the ever-changing public opinion. It may be the small public of a single congregation which pays his salary, or the national audience of a TV ministry. No matter what, he must be as the famous story is told of Gandhi. While being interviewed, Gandhi noticed a large group of people passing by his window. He left the interview and said, "These are my followers. I must find out where they are going so that I may get in front of them and appear to be leading them there." The same advice is expressed in a greeting card. It says that when you are being ridden out of town, keep in front and tell people that you are leading a parade. The Protestant, in essence, has no freedom, except the freedom of the slave who never knows what his master will dictate next. The Catholic, however, has the freedom which comes from the eternal and unchanging truth. He has the freedom of the accountant who understands mathematics. He has the freedom of the physician who knows how to cure a disease. He has the freedom of knowing what God has decreed and what God has revealed. He has the freedom to choose among goods, good acts, good things, good courses of actions. Why? Because he has truth, and all freedom must be based upon truth and reality. The unchanging truths of Catholicism can give the man the basis by which he can make decisions, selections, and choices. And there is no other place where he can go to learn these eternal truths. I ask you now, which is the better freedom? Is it the freedom of knowledge and truth? Or is the freedom of the spoiled child who knows nothing more than his own whims? And now ask yourself, which is more attractive? And that's one reason why a man would become a Catholic and a convert. Subdivision number 3, the problematic God, part 1. Catholics may very well at times become angry with God. If a series of disasters fall upon us, we may very well raise our fists and wail at heaven. This is understandable, and it is forgivable, even though it is not a proper behavior. The Protestant does not feel this passion. The Protestant does not feel passions in his religion at all. It is not that the Protestant is not human. Of course he is. He may feel passion for his family, for his wife, for his school, for his sports teams, for his country, but not for nor against God. And there is a very simple reason. To the Protestant, God presents a problem. And until the Protestant can figure out God, he simply can't get very much involved with God. And without involvement, passion cannot exist. Before I go further, let me point out that passion is akin to love, and is sometimes an expression of love. It is passion which leads to change, to reform, to victories on battlefields. A life without the possibility of passion is a pale, insipid life indeed. And a religious system which has no possibility of passion is a religious system which can never fulfill a life nor fill a heart. To return to the main point, why is God a problem for the Protestant? To answer this, the reader must try to imagine himself with a very different mindset. The Catholic knows that somewhere the formal doctrine of the Church is written. He may not know this formal doctrine of the Church by memory. He may not even know where this writing is, but he knows that if he took the time and effort, he could find it. There is, so the Catholic realizes, a way to settle all issues. Ultimately, the Pope could speak, or a council meet, or a definitive declaration be consulted. This does not mean that all Catholics obey all the teachings of the Church. It does mean that all the teachings are available to all Catholics. The Catholic sees his Church as the medium by which God communicates to man. All he, that is the Catholic, need do is to understand what the Church has pronounced, and the matter is closed. When Rome speaks, the case is closed. Then the Church may proceed then this individual Catholic may proceed to become passionate, or a sinner, or an apostate, or a martyr, that is, a saint. Examine this last bit of information, if you would, and remember, I'm trying to give you a concept of a different mindset by first giving you the mindset of a Catholic, which you may not even realize you possess. Should the Catholic choose to die rather than deny, say, the Immaculate Conception, he dies in the complete assurance that the Vatican will not, some years later, change this dogma. After his death, a martyr's death, the Pope will not decree that the Church is changing her mind and the Immaculate Conception is no longer a valid truth. It is assurance such as this which allows a man to shed his blood for the truth of some abstract value. It allows passion based upon truth alone. Now, I would like you to drop that mindset and try to see things in the mindset of the Protestant. The more the Protestant learns history, the more he learns that his tradition, his traditional views or his customary views or the views he holds now, are seldom more than a generation or two old at most. He learned that what Luther taught as absolutely correct is no longer taught by or held as true by Lutherans. It is merely history. He learns that the Reformed churches have abandoned the doctrines of Calvin, and the Methodists have ignored Wesley's teachings. Everything changes in Protestantism. This is not quite correct. Everything changes, but endless change. That is the only constant. One of the basic elements of love is this, that the lover know the beloved. Even if his impressions are mistaken and his love is merely an illusion, he must know something. If the beloved is different every day, if there is no continuous identity, the lover cannot love. All he can do is become confused. He cannot even find and identify his beloved. Now examine again the Protestant. No matter what he learns that he should never fully commit himself to it. New discoveries may change the doctrines which are so strongly held this week. He should not hold that divorce is always forbidden, never forbidden, sometimes forbidden, or always allowed. He needs to remain flexible. He is like the professional politician who understands that he must, in order to remain elected, follow the party line. The politician is not bothered by the fact that the Democratic Party now advocates policies which the Republican Party used to advocate but now opposes. If this were pointed out to him, he would point out that politics is the art of compromise, and compromise means to bring about a change. Now imagine the mindset of this type of a politician in the person of a Christian. He has to hold that Jesus came to earth and died to bear witness to the truth and to bring about redemption, and that he, Jesus, claimed to be truth itself, and that he promised his followers that they would know the truth and that the Spirit of truth would lead his followers, that is Christians, to all truth. Then keep in mind that the Protestant, for again, this is why what we're concerned with, is told that all he needs to know is in the Bible. God has spoken, the words are recorded, and the Protestant has access to them. Sometimes when speaking about the Bible, The Protestant will say that it is the blueprint for living. It seems as if the Protestant has the equivalent of the Catholic, the Rome has spoken, the case is closed situation, doesn't it? He should have it, but in fact, he does not. I shall explain why. The reason is that the Bible simply isn't clear enough to act as a blueprint for anything. The law books of the Bible contain thousands of words dealing with numerous situations. And yet Jewish rabbis have added millions of words and thousands of volumes in commentaries, and still the Jews of today are split into dozens of different traditions, each apparently based on the same original book, which should serve as a blueprint. If we read the New Testament, we see the bitterness of the various competing Jewish sects of the times, the Pharisees, the scribes, the Sadducees, the Essenes, and then there were the priests and the high priests and the Levites and the rabbis. The words of Jesus at times seem to imply salvation by works. Sometimes they seem to imply salvation by faith, and sometimes both. There is simply no way to use the Bible alone to develop a consistent theology unless one ignores a great deal of the Bible. To put it another way, what must be done is that a theological system is selected from among the candidates, and then everything which is supportive of it is read, studied, quoted, and commented on, and everything else is simply ignored. This is what the Protestant does. He makes a selection for a system, selects certain verses in Scripture, and throws the rest of it out. It's like trying to build a house with a blueprint when you tear up and throw away three quarters of each page. Needless to say, the house won't stand. Of course, the Protestant does not admit ignoring so much of the Bible. He cannot admit ignoring the Bible. So what he does is to advance the theory that much of the Bible is not understandable, taking the quote of St. Paul that we now see through a glass darkly. The Protestant argues that the darkness is too great, and that except for a few passages which support his own particular view, this darkness cannot be penetrated even by the light of the grace of God. This particular view will change as he changes churches, or as his one church that he stays in changes with the theological seasons and fashions and styles. Then what was dark before will become clear, and what was clear will become dark, confusing, and amorphous. But nevertheless, the majority of the Bible will always remain confusing and ambiguous at best. However, such a view is not tenable. Why does the Bible exist except to guide man? This is where the problem with God begins. If man cannot understand the Bible, then the fault lies either with man or with the Bible. However, no matter the choice that the Protestant makes, the problem lies actually, according to the Protestant, with God. In other words, he makes a third selection, even though he is limited to the two I've mentioned. Either, according to the Protestant, God did not write the Bible correctly, that is to say, clearly enough for man to understand it, or man was not created in such a way to understand it correctly. I hope you understand that both of these statements are direct attacks on God. Why would God write a book which could not be understood on this side of the grave? When finally understood on the other side of the grave, it would be too late for it to do any good. Bible study classes in heaven would be archaic as well as silly. But why would God create man who cannot understand the book written by God for man? If one makes this selection, God is being silly or playing a great cosmic joke on his creatures. Of course, the Protestant tries to tackle this problem by pointing out that man is corrupted, depraved, destroyed by sin. Thus, he argues, the fault is that man cannot understand good. But this argument, this attempt to weasel out of a confrontation with the truth, cannot withstand examination. The Bible was written after man fell, not before. God knew he was dealing with the fallen nature of man. And we men know how to read and use and understand many books. We use telephone directory, cookbooks, and computer manuals. And we can read with perfect understanding blueprints of bridges so that they don't fall down. Man can and does understand books. Man can and does understand and recognize good when he sees it. St. Paul tells us in this very Bible that men will be judged by the law that is written in their hearts if they have not had the formal law preached to them. This means that man knows truth even without the Bible, and he is to be held responsible for this knowledge of truth and what he does with this knowledge. The Protestant must somehow agree that he is supposed to understand and apprehend truth. Then he must somehow argue that it cannot be done. God expects man to do, in the Protestant's view, what no man can do. This, of course, is a problem which he attributes to God. Rather than find fault in himself, the Protestant will find fault in God. Somehow God becomes a Shakespearean character with some massive fatal flaw which destroys the effective use of his power and authority. Why didn't you get it right? The Protestant asks God. Of course, if he really asked the right question, he would cease to be a Protestant. And the right question is this: if you, O God, expect me to be perfect, as Jesus tells us we must be in the Bible, then where is your perfect church? And should he ask this question with a full and sincere heart, should he ask for this, then he would receive the answer, and he would know why he should be a Catholic. The answer that he would receive from God is this: my church has always remained my bride. She cannot be reformed. She can only be identified, accepted, and loved. Yet this is a problem with God, with his very nature, which the Protestant cannot resolve as long as he remains a Protestant. The Catholic, of course, as I pointed out, has no such problem. For the Catholic, the system is complete. The Bible, all of the Bible, supports the Catholic system of beliefs. It is a tremendous gift of profound consequences, which is overlooked by most of you cradle Catholics, because it has always been there. It is much like health. He who has never had a toothache will not easily realize the pain he has been spared. Those who have suffered and then visit the dentist to have the tooth drilled suffer to have this pain eliminated, health restored. Then both persons are not in pain and are on the same, in the same situation. The one who has never suffered should be more grateful, but he is not likely to be, unless someone can tell him how lucky he is to have avoided all of that pain. In a sense, that is one of the things I have tried to do in this subdivision, to make you realize how fortunate you are and how grateful you should be to have never suffered the pain of the confusion which the Protestant endures every day of his life. Please consider this subdivision as a visit to the dentist, which you did not have to make. Please be grateful. Subdivision number 4, The Problematic God, Part 2. I have just explained why the Protestant has a problem with God, in that God seems, according to the Protestant, to have created man in such a way that man cannot fulfill what God intends for him. What this leads to is the doubting of God rather than the doubting by the Protestant of himself. In other words, as the God-man relationship is not right, the Protestant, quite logically, sees something wrong with one or the other of the parties. Unfortunately for him, he attributes this defectiveness to God and not to himself. Unable to find the solution outside of Rome, he blames God. The problem is one of identity. The Protestant cannot become Catholic and still be Protestant. If his identity is more important to him than achieving peace and satisfaction on earth, he will remain a Protestant and refuse to become a Catholic. To help the Protestant change and come home, you would need to show him why it is worthwhile for him to do so. And one suggestion is to expose this defective Protestant view of a so-called defective God. There is another problem with God which confronts the Protestant, and it is far more basic than the difficulty with knowledge, which I have already alluded to. It is the problem of suffering. In a certain sense, everything which I suggest in this comment from a convert tape is concerned with suffering. I am suggesting that the Protestant can find an easing of his suffering only in his true home of all men, the Catholic Church. Let me explain what I mean by suffering. Suffering, in its most essential form, is any continued type of pain or discomfort which has a common source. To attempt to make my point as clear as possible, allow me to make some gross distinctions. I am dividing suffering into 3 general types. Before I do, let me point out that I am not referring to the simple routine pains of life, such as the stubbed toe or the bumped head. Pain can be considered a problem in itself, and I shall not deal with it here. Allow me simply to say that pain can serve a productive purpose as a warning system which may prevent a more serious injury or death. I emphasize that what I mean by suffering is the continual, repeated series of pains which are caused by one event or one situation. This type of suffering may be the result of ignoring the early warning painful signs.
At the risk of an oversimplification, allow me to point out that the functioning of purgatory, in which every act of suffering, when endured in a state of grace, can lessen the other suffering that will take place either for ourselves or our loved ones in purgatory gives meaning to every act of suffering. In other words, to us, every act of suffering, similar to that of our Lord on the cross, can be one of an act of love, compassion. To the Protestant, every act of suffering is nothing but a cruel act inflicted by a hateful God on the creatures he despises. This talk will continue on tape 2. Thank you for listening.